This is an interview for the Mill Workers Oral History Project. The date is February 6th, the year 2006, and we're at Maine Heritage Weavers in Lewiston, Maine, and I'm interviewing Danny Fitzsimmons, and this is Andrea Lungia. Could you start just by giving me your full name?
Danny E. Fitzsimmons. E stands for Edward.
And what's your date of birth?
October 25th, 1957.
And where were you born?
Lewiston.
Did you grow up in Lewiston as well?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What was the Lewiston community like when you were growing up, in terms of looking at it at the way it is today?
a little bit more on the rough side. The taverns and the bars that line Lisbon Street. One of them being the Menoir, which was a really a rough and tumble bar room over on Lisbon Street. The mills, both Bates and Libby's, and the shoe shops and everything was really running a lot. There was a lot of activity. I remember the railroad tracks and the train that would come down and load off their bales of yarn and stuff in the big. I guess they had to have a station down where the number 8 mill is, where the bank is now. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, there used to be like railroad tracks running across there. And you would always see locomotives down there and stuff. So that was that way when I was a kid. And I remember we once borrowed the hand trolley on the rail. We wasn't supposed to, but somebody forgot to lock it up. We took it for a spin. It was more laid back, I think, in a ways, because you know you didn't have a lot of the pressure that you have today, and I think jobs were a lot easier to come by. If you got done in one place, you'd be hired the next. You know, the next mill would hire you, and you know some people would just keep bouncing between the mills. Lisbon Street was bustling. I remember all the stores. There was Woolworth, W.T. Grant's. There was Five and Nine. There was quite a bit of stores on Lisbon Street.
Was this in the 70s, did you say?
Yeah, in the early 70s. Used to have a small paper route with a friend of mine, and we would get our papers. We would always order like 25 to 50 more papers than our paper route. And we would always get prime dollar for them because we'd go down to a bus station, the bus stops, because there were people all over the place. They would use the bus a lot. And every day we'd sell out of the newspapers, and we made more of a profit on that in a week's time than what the paper route gave us. So it worked out pretty good for us. But there was a lot of activity on Lisbon Street, whereas now there's not hardly any. People like to go down Lisbon Street. They enjoyed shopping on Lisbon Street, then they turn the street into a disaster that they have now, where you're in one side and then you got to go to the next side and you got to go to the next side. By the time you get down to the main street, you change the lanes about 4 or 5 times. That was supposed to alleviate the traffic on Lisbon Street. Well, it did manage to alleviate the traffic, but it also managed to alleviate the businesses on there too, because you know they needed the traffic in order to have the business.
Right.
And when the city decided that they were going to beautify it, they made a big mistake there. The people were much more friendly, I think. Yeah.
Did either of your parents work in the mill or the shoe shop?
Oh yeah, so it goes goes way, way back.
Can you talk about how far back it goes in your family and who they were?
Let's see, it would have to be my... I know my grandfather did. And my mother. My father. my mother was a spinner. My father had been a weaver. My uncle worked in the French department. My cousins worked in the complex. I don't remember quite where. My uncles both worked. One of my uncles worked in the card room for quite a few years. He worked in the Hill Mill, which was a division of the Bates. Bates had three divisions. There was the Bates Fabrics, and then it was Hill, and then there was the Edwards Complex in Augusta. And my uncle worked at the Hill Mill for, I'd say about 20 some odd years. I think 20, 21, 22, somewhere around that area. The Hill Mill closed. And he ended up transferring the... They had a problem because the Hill Mill was closing. They were a part of the Bates Mill. But the seniority wouldn't transfer, and they were going to lose all the seniority, and they wouldn't step down. They allowed them to bring their seniority for such things as the vacation pay and stuff like that, but not to for job bidding. They could do that for job bidding, but not for seniority purpose of the to be on the job.
Like the management?
No, it was like if you were a weaver and you had 20 years in Hill Mill and you transferred that over to Bates, another person that was at Bates only had 17 years, your seniority wouldn't rule over his.
Yeah.
Their seniority had more leeway, but mostly their seniority was just been given for their benefits more than anything else. Their vacation pay, their pension, stuff like that, mostly for the benefits.
Now, your uncle was one that was at Hill Mill and then transferred over?
Yep.
How did he feel about losing that seniority piece?
Nobody could be happy about that.
No.
And they just start all over again, as far as being the low man on the totem pole again,
Was there any, did he ever talk about there being tension between the workers that were put together
No, he got along pretty much with everybody. Got along pretty much with everybody else. It was a work environment, and you wanted to work, people pretty much got along with everybody, and they had banquets every year. They had a banquet every year, Bates Mill banquet. At one of the banquets, they had this before my time, but they had Maurice Chevalier at one of their banquets, and there was would fill the entire Lewiston Armory. And it was a big, big thing. I think they had Rudy Valley at one time also. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that. That was one of the major parts of the union. I can remember is the union of the Bates. The Bates was one part, but an integral part of that base was the union part.
Mm-hmm.
Without including the union into the history of Bates is doing it as a service, because it is a big part of it, whether it's good or bad. It was a big, big part of Bates, and people were more in the weave rooms than anything else, were very strict on their union. They wanted things done a certain way, and sometimes it was a little bit too much, but sometimes, it had to be done.
Now, was the union already in place when you started working?
Oh, yes. Yes, the union was there in the, I think, the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
Probably
late 40s, early 50s?
Yeah.
And did you work with Denny Blay at all?
I remember Denny. I was just a young peon at the time, you know, wise guy, you know, being young and stuff. But I did go to the union meetings. I did meet Denny Blair. There was a few others after him. Mr. Oliver. And he was a business agent for a while. Then after Mr. Oliver, we had Michael Cavanaugh. And from Michael Cavanaugh, we had another woman. I don't remember her name.
Right. Lucille Barrett?
No, she would be she was a president of the union, of the local.
Okay. But this was the higher up person
right.
we're talking about.
Initially, when they first started, the union was the United Textile Workers Association.
Mm-hmm.
Then they changed over to AFL-CIO because they merged in, and they had different business agents as time went by.
Did you ever hear of Rose Gilman? Does that name sound familiar?
I know she was
in the union, but I wasn't sure how she might have connected. So,
And it's not ringing no bells.
Now, you mentioned both your mother and father worked in the mills. What were their names?
My mother's name was Elizabeth Turcott. My father's name, he's actually my stepfather. He was working as a weaver. His name was Rainey Turcott.
And was it your mom's father that also worked in the mill? You said
yes.
He had a grandparent?
Yes. I can't even remember his name, but he worked in the mill. Her mother, that's hard to remember what she was doing. I think she was disabled with the lungs, if I remember right. When I was just a little kid.
Mm-hmm.
But he had worked in the mill. I think some of the pictures of what I've seen was a backdrop of the mill and some of the pictures I've seen in the times gone by. But just about everybody I think it worked in that's been in the family worked at the base at one time or another.
So it was something that connected your family.
I wouldn't say it's a good lifelong tradition, but it was a good place to work.
Mm-hmm.
You got a good wage, not the best in the world, but you got a good wage. You made an honest wage. Mm-hmm. You were treated with respect on the most part. Sometimes you had to fight with respect. but you knew what you were expected to do. What was expected of you when you went in the work, and you did what you was expected of, and then you went home and you got your paycheck every week. And a lot of people depended on that. Of course, when imports started making a direct impact on the mills, and people losing their jobs, that hit Lewiston hard in the later 70s when they started shutting parts of the mill off and laying off people and having huge layoffs. At that time, Libby was experiencing problems as well, and their payroll had gone down. And the unemployment office was packed to the gills with people in line waiting for, somebody to get their unemployment. And it was difficult for a lot of people at the time, because I remember when I was a kid, the police officer would stop the traffic on Canal Street to let the people out, and it'd stop the traffic for at least 10-15 minutes, because it would take that long just for the line of people to get from the door out, And they'd be going up Ash Street, and all you would see is from the bottom of the gates all the way up, all you would see was just massive people walking up, you know, because there were so many people. There were thousands of people that used to work in these mills, and when they let them out, it was just had to stop traffic. There was no way around it. And they were stopping for about, you know, 10 minutes before the line was enough where they could hold the people back and let the cars go, you know. But it was something else. All you see was a flock of people coming out, you know. And you had they'd be coming out. You had the one right across the street here, was someone would come out there. And the main entrance and exit, they would mostly come out there, but they would come out two doors. And all you could see is a mass of people coming through the doors as you go across the bridge. And there was a lot of people. And it used to be, you know, it used to be nice to see that famous amount of people. And they were all on their way home, and, you know, a lot of them would stop at shop on Lincoln, Lisbon Street, or they were all heading home, and going on the buses and taking their bus. Not a lot. It wasn't, I have to say, you know, back then there wasn't a lot of people that drove to work. Mm-hmm. Most of the people walked to work. So I don't think you had maybe 25% commuters were actually driving. The rest of them were all just people that lived around in the neighborhood. So, whereas today, when you get an operation, anywhere, you know, people are driving, you have to have cars, you got to have a lot of parking area, you know. Back then, mostly everybody walked to work. Today, they don't do that no more. You got lazy a bit, I guess.
Now, at the time you worked there, were there always three shifts running, or did that change over the years?
When I started, everything was three shifts. But the shifts were varied from depending on where you worked. If you worked in the main area, which was Bates, that the shift there was three shifts. If you worked on the security, those shifts were different. The security guards kept totally different shifts. Worked at the Pepperell Mill, where we used to have a screen print operation at the Pepperell Mill, which is the bleachery. I don't know if you, when you come down Lisbon Street Hill, on the right hand side there, there's a big mill complex there. Well, that's the old bleachery, and that there we used to have a screen print where we would put pat on the bedspread, not woven in, but painted on, whatever. Mm-hmm. They never make the designs on the spread. There they ran two shifts. And their shift started from 6 to 2 and from 2 to 10. It was a little different than the other one there. The watchmen's there would vary greatly on the watch. So I can't really give you any definite.
No, that's okay.
Schedule
yeah.
on there.
Well, let's talk about, you've had several different positions in the mill over mm-hmm. the years. Do you remember them in order, or should we just talk about the different...
Let's see, I'll try to get them in order. Let's say I was 17 years old.
Because I'm interested to know what the jobs were and describing how you did them.
Okay, well, the first job I started out was a slasher helper, which was in the slashing room. And what I would do there is they had the beams, which was long pipes with yarn wrapped around it, and they weighed approximately a ton. And they would be on rails, they were stacked about three high. And we had this machine where you would go in with the machine, and it was on hydraulics, and it would lift it up, and you'd have to get the hooks into these beams and pull it up and then out and then down and put it on the truck for the weave room to use. And they would give you a sheet each day of what was to come out, and you'd have all these beams ready for the weave rooms to be taken. They had two different weave rooms. They had one and two weave, and they had number five weave. And so you had to keep one and two weed was green trucks, and number five weed was yellow trucks. So you always had to make sure you kept the right trucks on the right walks if you were getting out. And that was part of it. The other part was about twice a night we had to piece up the one of the slashers that made the Terry beams. And by piecing up, I mean they would take a it would run out the spool, mm-hmm. and then you manually had to tie another spool into that one. And most of them are running about between 350 and 480, somewhere around there, ends to that walk. So it would take, you know, two people to a little while, about a half hour, 45 minutes, where they have to piece that all back up together. So that slasher would keep it going. And then the other part would be to pick up all the waste and bring it over to the waste house. But they used to have a waste house where they compress it, where they put all the waste on, and then they would repick it again and reprocess the whole thing again, and then you'd be back into yarn again. So they didn't waste a lot back then.
Yeah.
Today we tend to have more waste.
Mm-hmm.
After the slashing room, what happened there was I ended up getting bumped there because the job was only temporary. So because they had another one that was got laid off, and his job, he had department seniority, and I, since I just started, I didn't really have any, and I hadn't had a posted job and all of this, so I lost the seniority, so he got me, bumped me, and I went from there. I went up to one and two weave, and I became a cloth doffer, which basically just takes off the finished, after it's finished woven, it runs into a roll. At that point, we would just take off the rolls and put them in the storage where they would be processed after. And that was on third shift, which really sucked. But it wasn't too bad. You know, you had a job to do. You knew exactly how much you had to do. Once you did that, that was all that was expected of you. And we could go in there basically and start up at 11 o'clock. And the first thing we'd do is go around to all the looms and measure the rolls, and then we'd mark it down on paper, and then we just go out and we just go through them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of nights we got done like 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, and our job was done. And all we did after that was just sit around, drink coffee or whatever. And so it wasn't a bad job. You know, the bosses didn't hassle you as long as you got your work done. That was their main thing: get your work done. You know. And so, you know, each night we made sure. Some nights you'd have a fixer or a changeover that needed to get to the loom, you know, and they needed to have the doff rolled off so they could get to work on it. And they would just ask us, and, you know, we just, no problem, we go over and doff it, even though it was over and above our normal. So I think it used to be 65 cuts a night. but of course, the idea was one hand washes the other. You know, they're not going to complain if you're sitting around doing nothing, smoking cigarettes or drinking coffee, you know, if you do a nice thing when they need it. And that's, people work together like that a lot. You may not have that in the workplace today, but you know, back then it was nice. People, the bosses, and everybody pretty much worked together. Sometimes they had their problems. Who don't, but on the most part, I'm pretty good. From the weave room, I went to screen print, and I was there for approximately 3 years. I was a screen printer, and what that entails is setting the machine up, the repeats, in order to make a design on a bedspread.
Mm-hmm.
It may be two screens, it may be four screens, it may be eight screens, and each screen has got a design, and which also coincides to a color of the dye. So when the belt would move over, you had to make sure that the design would intertwine with the other design so that when it came out, it would look like one complete design.
Did you work closely with the design department?
No. They just made the screens, and we just set up the machines that ran them. And the length of the machine was probably, I don't know, 60 feet, 70 feet. It was a long, long machine. And you had a dryer at one end. You had the roll, the scray in the front end, and you had the dryer in the rear. And it would go through, and it would make the screens, and the different colors would be used. And you'd do that, and then you had style changes, so you had to bring them over into the washroom. Those screens had to be all washed by hose. And you put your next ones down, and you would turn around and have to reset your repeat and stuff. That's what I used to do. Also, another part of that job was color. We had a dye wear that would make the colors, but sometimes the colors wouldn't be right. And we had a supervisor and the printer. The screen printer would take the swatch out to the dryer, would cut a piece out. And then we had a master sample that we had to match. And both the supervisor and the screen printer had to agree that the colors were dead matched. The supervisor could not just okay it unless the screen printer operator also agreed, and vice versa. So those two had to agree that there was nothing wrong with that color. And the dye wearer was always the person that would get a little upset because, everybody sees a little color differently. And because these are being held in hotels, they have to be dead on all the time. And so that was why I had to have two people, and why, the dye wearer would always say, I'm going to have to put a little bit of this. I got to go back and make this. But that was the way it was.
Yeah.
But he understood at the end that's what's got to be done, and so that was the job. I was there about 3 years. From there, I went on to security because it looked like they were going to have layoffs at the screen. But I liked the job; I really did enjoy it. But when push comes to shove, we saw the white writing was on the wall, and it wouldn't be that long before that would at least drop one ship, where it would be down one ship, where it'd be out of work. So at that point, a job on the board came up for security and said, I'll try that. So I went over there and did security about a year. And basically the security was, this what it says, just take care of making sure people don't try to steal bedspreads, make sure the fires or and how to react to fires. One of the main things was don't call the fire department, and most times they cause more damage than the fire does. They start hacking away at the roof, and it's a lot of money to repair the roof. There's been a few bad fires over the mill, but on the most part the people were able to put the fires out. The firemen ended up causing more damage than they did any good, but the other thing we had to worry about is water. Back then, we had a serious problem with the roof leaking. And so we would have barrels, and the water would drip from the ceilings, and we have to empty the barrels all the time. It was one of the biggest things when it had rain. When it was raining, the watchmen would dread going in there because they know they had all night long. They'd be emptying buckets and buckets of water. Some nights one watchman would go out and do the drive, while the other one would go in, and each drive took about an hour. And then you'd come in, and then the other one would go out on his drive for an hour. And then all night long, you'd be swapping that way. But sometimes when it was raining, you just couldn't get it done in an hour. Mm-hmm. And you'd get back, and then he'd have to go out a little bit off schedule. Sometimes he'd totally miss his drive because the water was so bad. And then he'd come back to the same problem. He has the same problem. But mostly it was number five and number three, Spinny, had the most problems with roof leaking. And that was a headache. And you know, we had to worry about people trying to break in.
Did you have a lot of problem with that?
At one time there was a couple guys that broke in and they were armed with a shotgun. There was a watchman that was doing his run down by the dye house. When he come upon them, they were on the canteen area, the vending machines. They were breaking into the vending machines. And when the watchman came up to the around the corner, they grabbed him and they put the gun to his head and they threatened to shoot him and everything. They did let him go, and then they took off. They threw the gun down in the little ravine down there, and the cops ended up catching him anyway. But that watchman soon left the watchman. He signed for another job, and they had enough of that. I don't blame him. But there was commotions at times, you know. Mm-hmm. People not just breaking in, but people trying to break out.
Now, what were they trying to break out for?
Well, you know, that you were there and you didn't have a punch card. Mm-hmm. Everything was driven by light. You had a red light in different places all over the mill. You had the red light. Red light would meaning that it was time to leave. It was 3 o'clock, or it was a shift change, mm-hmm. one of them. And so, you know, the boss would come over, see if you were working, if you was ready, take a roll call. And, you know, some guys would turn around, and as soon as they were noticed, they turn around and try and take off and down to the Holly, which was a strip joint there on Main Street.
Oh, the Holly, yes, yeah. I've heard of that.
Well, they go down to the bar rooms down in Elizabeth Street. Some of them, you know, came in intoxicated before you're starting their job. But most part, the bosses would usually tell them to leave, and they wouldn't do too much to them, unless it was a continual habit.
Right.
But some of them would sneak out and they get caught. You know, they'd get rid up and, you know, things could happen to them that were very nice. So that was the security.
And then was it on to the card room or finishing?
For the card room, I was only at the card room for about a month. And I started and you had like, I think it was like a week or two to try out the job and decide whether to go back or not. And I remember being in the card room and just beginning to learn how to run the cards. And we had a supervisor there that was not very nice, not very well liked at all.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason he decided to pick on me. And I just told him that I was too young for this shit and I didn't need it. And so I went in and I said, I want to go back to my job. So I ended up going back on the watch for, ended up getting like another month before another job came up that I wanted to try.
Mm-hmm.
And that was on the washes in the finishing room. But I didn't stay very long in the card room. But I got to know a lot of the guys and you know, they were really nice guys. And my Uncle Arthur, he worked in the picking room, which was part of the card room area.
Yeah.
And and when I was on the watch, you see my mother, I would see my uncle, you know, they would be working in different parts of the mills, but you know, I get to see all these people.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was nice. But when I went on to the wash, I just ended up staying there for 6 years, I think. 6 or so years. And it was very, very busy at the beginning. When I started, They told me I'd have to go to third shift, even though I signed for second. And that's when the union came in, and I said, no, I signed for second. And they had a guy that they had taken off the street and trained him, well, this job is... And I said, well, no, he's going on second shift. I said, no, I'm going second. I got a union here. I'm paying my union dues. And so we had to fight it out, and because the other guy said he would quit if he had to go on the third shift. I said, well, that's tough, because, you know, I signed for the job. I've got the award of the job. I have a union, and so that's what happened. He ended up quitting, and I ended up being on second shift. But we ended up, it was a very difficult job, very, very difficult, very strenuous. There was a man there named Leon Oji, and he was just a tiny little guy, but he was built up for that, and that's what he did, and he went right through that with no problem. For like a month and a half, all I had was pain, where I never thought pain existed. But after I got over there, my muscles became adapted to it, and it was fine. And I enjoyed working there, but we would have people come in to learn because they needed the third shift on that. And me and Leon was running 12 and 16 hour shifts all the time just to try and get by. Money was good, you know, time and a half. We were working Saturdays and Sundays, so it was time and a half, double time on Sunday. Making all kinds of money. No life to yourself, but all kinds of money. So they kept trying to get somebody on third shift, and because the job was so strenuous, they wouldn't last a couple of days. Some of them wouldn't even last a couple of hours. That would go on. But then after a while, that because of the imports, you know, we started losing a lot of orders. We had JCPenney's, we dealt with Sears, we had a lot of big customers, and when I went in. In the afternoon, I started that. I was working second shift. There was no way you were going to get caught up on all the baskets of bed springs that were there in front of me. I was as far as I could see. And so later on, that wasn't happening. You could actually see where you were going to finish that night. So you could see the amount of product was not what it used to be. We had lost a lot of orders. Some of that was because of not getting the orders out on time and being efficient. And some of it, of course, being imports, being much cheaper.
Did you stay at the mill all the way until 2000?
In 2001.
And then?
Was it 2000? No, it was 2000. Yeah, that's when they closed in April.
And now you're working with Fred LaBelle at Maine Heritage Weavers. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? Did he give you a call one day?
Yep, he called me out. Well, what happened there was when the mill closed, they had a ready, which is a state. The state comes in with all the programs. They try to tell everybody what the programs are available. And get them squared away on unemployment on the quick end and stuff. One part of the system is if you have like large companies closing, they had peer support programs, what's called peer support. And they contacted me to be their peer support counselor, which I worked under the state. I was working at the Career Center for between 2000 and 2001. We had TRA, so it was a matter of getting people into their schooling, trying to get them either on the job training, whatever jobs we could get them, any education that we needed. So I had to funnel that through. So, you know, because people at that end was... you know, a lot of them had not have a high school education.
Mm-hmm.
Even some didn't know how to read and write. So you had some illiteracy there. You had some other problems that we had, you know, to get over and to get them into some kind of job. And you get them, hopefully, it wasn't going to be anything like they had, but it was, you know, a job. And mostly it was... mostly successful. I wish you could have done more, but you always want to do more, you know. But I was getting done because it only lasts a year for the peer support. And I was going to school. I already had my schooling papers all filled out and everything. Mm-hmm. And it was time I started in the school. Fred contacted me and said he wanted to start another company up and asked me if I'd be willing to, you know, help him do it. And he basically told me, it's like you're the only one left. You know, there was anything about those machines and stuff and setting them up and everything. There was another person, Leonard, at that time. He was working someplace else, so he was out of the loop and he wouldn't be able to help. And the others didn't have the knowledge of the majority of everything. Here we have not only looms, but we have heads, we have jackets. So you have to know the knowledge of the head, and you have to know the knowledge of the loom. Mm-hmm. And so there's quite a bit of knowledge as far as mechanical to deal with these machines. And so he just said, you know, if you don't want to do it, well, you know, I'm not even going to go any further, because he was looking into rental and he was looking into this and stuff. But he was like, if I refuse, he said, that would be the end of that, because there's no way, because it's just, it doesn't have the people with the knowledge out there to get this bar back up. Right. So, and I said, yeah, you know, I enjoy what I do. I had job offers in the tech industry, you know, for my degree in computer science, and I'm actually very good on computers. So I've had job offers on the tech end, but you know, I'm not a person that likes to sit at an office. You know, I love working with my hands. This is what I like to do, and I've always been that way since a kid. And this is what I do today, and I'm happy with it. It may even pay less than what I would probably get in the tech sector, but I probably would not be as happy as I am.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you today that you feel is very important to add before we end? Don't want to miss anything that was in your mind as something important.
The weave room. I can tell you about the weave room.
Mm-hmm.
The weave room, when I first started, my very beginnings, I was learning with Andy Langua, which was the head weave room technician. And when I started, they had just had 6 new looms installed. They were Salsa looms. And they were running on projectile, and but everything else was all shuttle looms, and the shuttle looms were C&K, Crompton and Knowles. That was C4s, the model number, and C9s, and the shuttle would go floppy flop, floppy flop, because it would shoot it from one end and shoot the shuttle with the yarn inside the other end, and that back and forth. But every once in a while the shuttle would come out and I've gotten hit by it a few times and it hurts, but that it was loud, much louder. I mean, when you went into the weave room, my god, it was the sound was deafening when you had over 100 machines running in that room, and the shuttle looms had the salsas were noisy, but you get all those C4s together and it was massive loud. But you know, after the funny thing is, after you're working it, after a few months, you start getting used to it and it actually starts putting you to sleep. You know, if you're working third shift, you can actually go to sleep in such a loud area, but you can do it, believe me. And I fall asleep there and at late nights, so. But it was very loud. People got together though, you know. And when people would retire, they would have a party for them, a little get together at the lunch break. Now, first shift had different lunch break than second and third, but every shift would have basically a little lunch break. And for whoever was retiring on that shift, they would have, during that lunch break, they would have a little cake, probably, or something, you know, while wishing that they were retiring. And that happened right until near the end. I'd say about early 90s. That started, you know, being passed over. People just retired and, you know, wasn't thought of anymore. And they just got happy they got there before it closed, you know. And like, you know, should we get there? But, you know, well, you're lucky. You know, we're not. So they kind of went out. But the people were great. I mean, yeah, the people were great.
Thank you very much.
Yep.